What is going on, everybody? Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. I'm your host, Curry Blandford, and today I'm talking to Erica Ramirez. So I've known Erica actually quite a long time. She used to go to my church, Life Church, kind of even before I was there. She went to Wheaton College. And so we've always sort of known who each other are, but never actually gotten to sit down and talk. And so I brought Erica on the show, and I got to be honest with you, I had no idea what I was sort of getting myself into with this conversation. It is so good. There's so much good stuff to this conversation. We talk about conspiracy theories, which is really big right now. And she has one of the most gracious takes on conspiracy theories I may have ever heard. And there's just a lot of grace in this episode. We talk about politics. We talk about Pentecostalism, and we define the difference between that and charismatic. And yeah, there's just a lot of good stuff. She does research now, but has this understanding of sociology of religion. That's what her PhD is in. And so much good stuff. And I think what I really love about this episode is Erica brings out what it is to work out of your family history. Like, her work is very, very captured by like her upbringing and the way God has sort of shaped her story to put her in the place that she is, give her the passions that she has. And I think this story really highlights that in some amazing ways. And so I can't wait for you to hear that. Just a reminder before we get the episode going to make sure you're following me on Instagram and Facebook at Theology of Hustle and on Twitter at Curry Blandford. You can stay up to date with everything going on with the podcast there. I also just launched Patreon a few weeks ago. So if you're interested in supporting the podcast, I would love for you to check out my Patreon page. You can find that on my website, on any of my socials, any of that. And yeah, I truly appreciate the support. It just helps keep, you know, the hosting fees down and all that stuff. I greatly appreciate your support, and I hope you enjoy hearing from Erica. Well, Erica, I can't say thanks enough for making some time and coming on the podcast. This is super fun.
Oh, I love it. I think podcasts are like the GarageBand update, right? Like, we have some great tunes in us. Let's make some jams. And I think that's a great way of being in the world. So thank you for inviting me.
I love that. That's awesome. It's a great analogy. Sweet. So let's just get started here and just have you sort of introduce yourself to everybody, sort of the, you know, flyover view.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm Erica Brian Ramirez. I'm currently director of applied research at Auburn Seminary. And before that, I was the Richard Parker assistant professor of Wesleyan thought and heritage at Portland Seminary. So I've had a little bit of a career shift right out of my doctorate, actually overlapping with my last year of my doctorate. I took a professorship at Portland Seminary, which meant I was teaching full time. And then I took this job in which I do a lot of heading up of projects. So I do project-based work for Auburn, and I don't teach.
Okay. Okay. So, you just had what do you mean by project-based? Like, are you in charge of a lot of different sort of research projects going on at the same time, or?
That's exactly right. Good guess.
Okay.
Actually, Auburn is this amazing institution where we get to pitch projects to philanthropists who are interested in seeing religion broadly construed, work for the common good, also broadly construed. So the work that I do, the beginning of a project would be my writing a narrative that would highlight a given issue in American or even global life, right? And I would say this needs an intervention along the lines of religious networks or religious ideas. Mm-hmm. And then the philanthropist or the funder in question would say, you know, I buy that. I buy that. That needs to be done in the world, and I'm going to fund this work. And then I would execute it. However, I promised to intervene, I would execute it with the help of people who are on staff at Auburn or through consultants who are called in to help.
Okay. That sounds awesome. I didn't even know that was like a thing. That's sweet.
It is really cool. I get to work at what, I mean, another way of saying it, Curry, is I get to work at the intersection of religion and politics, which is kind of funny because, you know, there for two reasons. One, you know, that old idea that religion and politics are the things you shouldn't talk over. And two, but here we are. And two, the idea that everybody kind of has an opinion about not just religion and politics, but also how religion and politics should or are working together. So I'm working in a space that is crowded by ideas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. And scholarly ideas and like just very, I mean, everybody has opinions about that, like down to like everybody, you know, like you can't kind of escape it, I think, in some ways.
I love it, actually. And I actually think that I'll just like drill down really quickly. I think evangelicals, which I'm not saying who is or who's not an evangelical, but I think evangelicals tend to be good lay sociologists. I mean, they have kind of a theory of the nation, a theory of the world, like eschatology, right, is a theory of how things are going to end. So actually, there's quite a bit of lay sociology that goes on and lay theology. And I actually think that a lot of the where our nation is, Curry, reflects that investment on people's back, like people who are not working in these spaces still have opinions in the spaces. And I think that that's what a democracy is premised on anyway, is that we would be people invested in the like in the life of the nation. So I'm not saying it's working perfectly, but to my mind, the public square should be a place crowded with ideas and stakeholders.
Yeah, I like that. I had never kind of thought of it that way, I think. Because it can be frustrating, right? I mean, it can be frustrating that there is this lay sort of sociology because you never know where, like what the basis is, you know? Yeah.
It's true. And I think that there are challenges that come based on that, right? Because, well, one of the things that I think democracy is premised on, Curry, is this idea of like the sacred feels of the people, like the people kind of know what's right and wrong. I mean, that it's not separate from ideas, but I think there's something visceral about democracy and that it's like the will of the people to be governed by certain kinds of people. So there's a lot of registers there. It's not just mental. And I definitely think there's an idea around like that the people, the American people, will know what's best for the nation and vote that way. But that, I don't think that's always true.
Yeah, it gets tricky, doesn't it? There's a lot of elements at play in something like that. Yeah.
We're all fallible and we are all at the mercy of like however good our chains of information really are. So I don't, it's to my mind, I love democracy. I'm willing to accept those like pressure points of fallibility, but they exist. They're real.
Yeah. Okay. I have one sort of random question. I want to dig down into your story, but this fascinates me. So would you say that what we have is still a democracy versus sort of like a oligarchy or like a plutocracy, you know, like governed by the wealthy? I mean, does that make sense?
Yeah, that I do think that the question makes sense. And of course, I've seen it in the media, various kinds of media, both more official and less official. And I could see something like that from somebody like a Cornel West. I'm not actually attributing it to him, but like what we would call like American political prophets could say, or like Bernie Sanders, right? Like America can't be run by an oligarchy. And I actually think that I know this sounds really funny, but I actually think that the degree that we're worried about that is healthy because I do actually think that democracy is co-optable, and you're asking me if it has been co-opted a little. I would say a little has been co-opted somewhat by oligarchy or by like forces that are not really like what people had in mind when we're talking about democracy. But I think the fact that we're worried about it and talking about it means we're not nearly so far gone as people think. Does that make sense? So I actually love when I hear people raise that alarm because I'm like, oh great. Like this kind of like awareness is still there. Like what we should be is not an oligarchy, right? We shouldn't be run by dark money, untraceable money, you know?
Yeah. Right. Well, And I'm sure we'll get into this, but then you have like this whole conspiracy theory thing, which is prevalent among like evangelicals and especially charismatics, I think, Pentecostals, and mixed in with all this, right?
A friend of mine wrote an article in the Washington Post, Dr. Leah Payne, And her article was about the propensity of, I mean, she, for lack of a better term, called it evangelicals, but Pentecostals and charismatics are right up there with it, to believe conspiracy theories. But actually, I'm very sympathetic to people who believe conspiracy theories, because what it generally reflects is a belief that you do not have access to the highest levels of information, information that people who have a lot more power than you have. And actually, those two things, I think, are true. So the actual shape, Curry, of conspiracy theories is often silly. I'll acknowledge it. But I think the feeling that you don't really know what's going on, I do think actually makes some sense. Because there are, for instance, I just read an article about transnational capitalism and how people don't really know how it works. And in fact, nation states have a really hard time. For instance, I'll just make one example. How Apple, the company, Steve Jobs' company, really resisted paying taxes to Ireland that the EU says it owes in back taxes. And Apple is saying they don't owe as much as the EU says they do. And the EU is having to use a lot of legal power to make that argument and then to try to collect. Well, people don't know, Curry, flat out. We have no idea how broken up supply chains and production chains work. And so when people feel that their economic fortunes are not what they wish they were, there is machinery at a much higher level than any of us can really put our finger on. And so, and I can point to it there. I can say, look, Apple has broken up the supply chain over a lot of countries in order to make it hard to pay taxes to any one nation state. And that sounds like a conspiracy theory, but it's one I could pretty much prove. But most people don't have their fingers that directly on the pulse of the outlines of conspiracy. So I think that it can often take on darker tones, like these people hate America. I don't think those kind of like emotional animus is not, for to my mind, always, it seems to show up a lot in conspiracy, but I think that's where conspiracy theories go wrong. And we're just looking for ways of naming, like, we're at kind of at the mercy of flows of capital that we don't know how to talk about. We don't even know how to think about. And we certainly don't know how to collect taxes from these businesses. So if I think one way people talk about this, Curry, and I'm sorry if I've lost anybody out there, but people think about like made in America pride. And they're like, we want to double down, triple down on buying things made in America. That's not a totally inappropriate feeling, but a fully extensive reason why that A, probably won't work, and is probably like the more how you could move from conspiracy theory towards actual financial assessment. Anyway, I don't know if that was very clear at all. I'm sorry. I'm doing my best here.
That was amazing. That was super clear. It was a way I'd never thought about conspiracy theories before.
Yeah, people, you know, Curry, I think people do a really good job. I think people are wanting to stay in the know about the current state and the fate of the nation, and I commend that. And I think conspiracy comes in when they feel victimized and they don't have a clear sense of whose fault that is.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. And it shows a lot more grace for people than just like, oh, you're a kookadoo and willing to sort of believe anything, right? It's like, no, there's some real, like, a real reason behind this. There's an ebb and flow to all this. And so like maybe pointing out more the reasons behind why somebody would feel that than, you know, making judgments about the actual belief, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. I think showing empathy is, you have to show empathy with the final analysis to empathize with like how a person got there. And I do think, for instance, if we're talking about, you know, the life of the nation, I think that such a polarized nation as we have become, empathy is really lacking. Mm. There are so many divergent discourses, Curry, on like what is best for the nation. And without a degree of goodwill and empathy for other systems of morality that are taking shape in our electorate, I think I can point out to times we vilify the other side. We're constantly vilifying each other. And I think it's such a mistake. We're more alike than we think we are. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. I think honestly, if we would just sit down and actually sort of talk to one another, it would be like a lot of these things would be solved maybe, or maybe listen as opposed to talking, I guess.
One thing that seems true about all of most of the population, the American, I struggle to say citizenship because people are really having a struggle identifying with the nation, but that's what we still are, the citizenry, right? I think all of us are really, most of us right now who are involved in culture are really concerned with the morality of the nation, which to me seems really counterintuitive since we're constantly seeing the other side as somehow immoral. Or labeling each other as moral. But it's, to my mind, kind of funny to watch us. I mean, I don't mean funny, haha, but it's kind of strange to see us constantly lobbing, like when we want to put down the other side, we say, well, you're totally immoral. Well, that's a particular, kind of a funny, it shows our preoccupation with morality.
Yeah. Well, and lack of a consistent basis for morality at the same time.
Mm-hmm. It's really tough to have divergent accounts of what the basis of morality is. I feel really bad for us. I have a lot of sympathy for us.
I like that. We need more sympathy for us.
It's hard.
It is. It is hard. Yeah, you're right. Awesome. That's fun. Let's take a second though. I want to jump back through your story for just a little bit. Do you mind sort of like, I would love to hear how you got to, becoming a scholar, if you don't mind. And I know that's a big broad story, but like, what was the why behind the trajectory you took into academia?
I think that one of the more honest versions of this answer would be, I grew up with a very analytical father who invited me into a little club of two where we would analyze a lot of things. And so it comes actually really, it's a second nature. It's part of like the currency of our family. Like we can, like if we get together for dinner, we'll probably talk about politics, whether it be in the national politics or church politics or anything, even family-based politics, like we would talk about it. And for a while, I thought that I would, there was another side of me who was really involved in worship leading at church. So for a while, I thought I would be a worship leader. And actually, I don't think that this is a story about how I'm not one. But for a while, it felt like that because I switched trajectories right after I had my first child, Judah, which I actually had while I was in Wheaton.
How old is Judah now? I remember him being a baby.
He was a baby before. He is 16.
Oh my gosh.
16 years old. And I had a really good advisor at Wheaton. So I went to Wheaton, still sort of pursuing my calling. So I had a sense of calling to the ministry. And I really wanted to go to Wheaton. And I ended up studying with Tim Larson, whom you may know. And actually, over the course of my doing an independent study with Tim Larson, and actually Edith Blumhofer, who passed away, was a scholar of Pentecostalism. She passed away this year. They both helped me to see that I had a really live historical project in my own grandparents' like immigrant Pentecostal church history. So that's where it started. It started with a school project. And over time, that just grew. It just had more and more leaves and branches, if that makes sense. The tree just grew. And at some point, I sort of thought I could do a doctorate. And then after, I think Judah was 5 years old when, I'm skipping over a lot of things, but I think it was kind of a sense of existential crisis. I'm like, I think I always thought I could get a doctorate in sociology of religion, which would unite my scholarly questions with my penchant for a lot of analysis. And the rest is history. So I showed up at Drew Theological School in 2011 and had a fabulous time. And I wrote a really inaccessible dissertation that I'm trying now to turn into a book that people can actually access and think with me and read. So that's how I ended up being a scholar. And of course, some of my questions started out historical and they've become historical sociological, meaning I care about the present, but I do a lot of work into historical analysis to analyze why we are where we are now and to chart a path forward. Mm.
Yeah, that's cool. I love that. It's interesting. So Tim was on the podcast, I don't know, two years ago, maybe now. No, not quite that long. But Tim was on, and it's because he has a very similar background to you, and like a, his is probably hyper Pentecostal sort of background, like his family, right? And as a historian, I'm sure some of those things aligned for the two of you. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I've actually really come to appreciate Dr. Larson in the intervening years as an amazing scholar. I mean, I knew him first as a teacher, and most teachers don't create whole syllabi around their own work. It's considered kind of, I don't know. And he doesn't either. So we read a lot of sources. I'm sure we read something of his, but I've read a lot of his work since then. And it's absolutely continued to shape my work. And yeah, he comes from, I think, a distinctly charismatic background. So do I. I grew up Pentecostal. And my dissertation, Curry, is about the Azusa Street Mission Revival. But I use French critical theory and sociology to reinterpret it.
Interesting. Okay. Let's stop right there. And do you mind just unpacking maybe for people who are unacquainted probably with these terms? Like when you say Pentecostal, you mean like, you know, maybe a couple of categories. And then when you say charismatic, maybe a couple categories and how those two sort, what do you mean by that?
There are some like tortured scholarly definitions that I'll avoid and I don't actually find very useful. So I think when people think now about Pentecostal versus charismatic, and sometimes you get like this idea around the neo-charismatic, you're talking about two distinct historical moments. You have classical Pentecostalism that is turn of the 20th century. So 1900 to 1915 is maybe a good, can maybe stretch it out to 1920. But people shift then because Pentecostals become more involved with evangelicals as a cohort around the 1920s. So classical Pentecostalism dates to around 1900 to about 1915 in my mind. And then charismatic, you find different treatments of this, but charismatic could be helpfully thought of as the diffusion of Pentecostal either sensibilities or practices into other distinct groups in the church. So in the 1960s, there was like a Catholic charismatic renewal when Catholics might be able to sing more traditional worship songs. More contemporary worship songs, and maybe could lift their hands and some even, for instance, speak in tongues. And you get some of that in the Episcopal Church too. And you've also got in, I think, the 1970s, around the same time, like maybe right after the development like of a West Coast charismaticism that could be like the Vineyard. You could think about the Vineyard as like typological of this. And so it's almost like it's both a historical progression, like classical Pentecostalism can be seen to diffuse through other groups in a way that makes them charismatic. Does that make sense? It doesn't make them Pentecostal. Yeah. And I actually really love the hard definition because my work is dedicated to like what makes the P, like what makes capital P Pentecostalism. And I don't think that Pentecostalism and charismaticism are the same. In fact, I know they're not. And they're importantly different. And I think when people think about Pentecostals, they think about weird behaviors. And I think that's right. I think people are right when they think about weird behaviors. And I think shying away from that does no one any favors. So sure. I both think Pentecostals are really weird. I think that's a fair definition. And then I think charismatics are a little less weird. They could get weird under certain circumstances. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it totally does. And I think like most people would probably have heard these terms and like not necessarily have been like, if you haven't been to a Pentecostal church, right? Like, or a revival or something, like it's hard to understand exactly what the differences are between that and like your just run of the mill, you know, evangelical Christian.
Yeah, that's right. And some Pentecostal churches over time, Curry, adding to the confusion, they've become themselves a little less capital P Pentecostal, and a little bit more lowercase p, sliding to the C in charismatics. So that adds to the confusion. But yeah, when people are thinking of what we call ideal types in sociology, the Pentecostals are the ones that are like slain in the spirit or speaking in tongues and talking a lot about the blessing that is the baptism of the Holy Spirit as sort of a distinct thing. And charismatics are going to do all of that, I think, to a lesser degree. They could go through a period of like getting kind of animated and sort of it sort of butt right back up into like the more Pentecostal sensibilities, but that doesn't always happen.
So would you consider the Assemblies of God a capital P Pentecostal denomination?
I haven't been that recently. So like part of my answer is like, okay. Well, I don't know. Right. Like I think maybe in some places, sure. What I think it makes I think two things would make my answer lean yes. One is one of my favorite discourses from Assemblies of God or Pentecostal proper churches is like, well, it's not been a long time. It's been a long time since we've had a revival, right? And like maybe the gifts have dried up. Maybe we need to seek the Spirit. That to me, to my mind, is a pretty like a classical Pentecostal discourse. Like the gifts are going out of operation. We need to stir them back up. The second thing is what they'll tolerate. And this is my favorite way of thinking about Pentecostals is like, it's not just what you do. It's also what you'll put up with. So maybe not every Pentecostal speaks in tongues, but to my mind, every capital P Pentecostal will allow for it and will believe that it has something to do with the Holy Spirit if it's not being faked.
Sure.
So that to my mind, it's not just the circulation or experience of revival or the stirring up of revival, but it's also like the placeholder for it, the regard with which it's held, the importance with which it's held, and even the seeking of it. I think that's capital P Pentecostalism.
Okay. And I read a couple of like random articles that I found on the internet that you have written.
Oh, wow.
Would you say that, well, you know, you got to do your research, right?
Great.
You're a researcher. would you say that both Pentecostals and Charismatics lean towards sort of a Zionist view of Christianity, like ethnic Israel or Jerusalem, sort of like being the future, the end times, the eschatology?
That's a great question. I'd be surprised if there are Charismatic or Pentecostal churches that don't have a degree of Zionism in them because of the way that Pentecostals like the apocalyptic texts and have traditionally. And so I don't know how you're a reader of Revelation or Daniel without thinking about Israel. So I guess my short answer is yes, to some or another degree. I think there's going to be Zionism. I think it can become more prominent when the church is itself more politicized. So in the article that you might be referencing, that the first article that I contributed to with my partner, Dr. Payne, for the Washington Post, we talked about the use of the shofar and the prayer shawl.
Yes.
And so like, you know, there's a continuum of like a spectrum there between like what my mom will do, which is she might like light a menorah for holidays and she's always been a Pentecostal and she'll use a prayer shawl. But then there's also like John Hagee, who has a church maybe just a mile from where I am right now and has like a decidedly very strong Israel, like bent toward Israel-centered discourse. And some of the Pentecostals I know, for instance, voted for President Trump, not just because of his willingness to try to curb abortion, but also his willingness to pay homage to the historical relationship the U.S. has had with Israel.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of those things that I don't think we talk about very much in Christian circles, especially, and I'll say this as a pastor, like it's one of those topics that's really important that like I very rarely find an opportunity to actually like talk to people about, you know, this relationship that Christians have with the nation of Israel, the modern nation of Israel, you know.
Yeah, there's a really good, I'm going to have to send it to you afterwards. There's a really good scholar of religion. I believe it's Willie Jennings, who has this whole theory about you can't really displace thinking about Israel because then you displace Jesus's Jewishness.
Yeah.
And that always ends up because our imaginations look for ways to identify and categorize people. Jesus always will undoubtedly end up looking pretty European if you don't keep Jesus' Jewishness in the picture. Jesus. So I think it's really important that we get better at thinking about what Israel does and can't mean in eschatological history. I mean, eschatological thinking. Eschatological history is not a thing, but
it's not a thing.
Yeah.
I guess if you're a preterist.
Yes, exactly. But, so my apologies to theologians in eschatology and in our like historical theology.
Yeah. That's interesting. That's good stuff. So, I mean, I know you grew up in Pentecostal church pretty much your whole life.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, yeah. So
I'm a third generation Pentecostal.
Third generation. Okay. Why devote so much time to like understanding like Pentecostals or talking about the history of that?
There is, as luck would have it, or if you want to say something like blessed and highly favored, Curry, if you want to like change registers, you know, there, it's interesting right now. There seem to be no shortage of commentators, like people who want to talk about the role that evangelicals and or Pentecostals are playing in U.S. politics. And actually, the truth is in global politics, because the president of Brazil right now, I think it's Jair Bolsonaro. I think that's how you say his name.
He has, sounds right.
His base of support is usually identified to be Pentecostals or AGs, AG Pentecostals, Assemblies of God Pentecostals. So it's amazing to me that the people around whom I grew up are having such an outsized influence on national and global politics. So fortunately for me, by studying my own, I certainly didn't have this in mind when I did the independent study work I did under Tim Larson, for instance, but fortunately for me, it proved timely. And I started out, my dissertation career is actually very different from this conversation, because I started out, I think if there would be a tagline for it, it would be make Pentecostalism weird again, because I had read a lot about Pentecostalism that didn't render it weird enough. And I'm really glad I listened to that intuition, because I think the strangeness or otherness, or scholarly word, the alterity of Pentecostalism has a lot to speak to us. And I think one of the tendencies of people who are sympathetic to Pentecostals is to try to render them similar to everyone else, when in fact they are quite different. And or they have a different pneumatology that is really critically important. For instance, if I say to you, oh, many Pentecostals believe that Donald Trump has been appointed to his role for such a time as this, right?
Right.
Suddenly you understand you're really not dealing with a straightforward political theology. It's a very complicated theology that makes recourse to, Curry, this is my favorite conversation, to monarchy or monarchical logic. Logic. That's right. And there's problems in that, because of course we're not living in a monarchy. So when I hear Pentecostals think about Trump's role as a king who's going to make a divine intervention to, for instance, save them or save us, like the capital US, from political harm. And I hear people invoked, right? Like Esther was even invoked for Trump, but right. Just tells you about the flexibility of the imagination, right? I think it's really interesting, I'm riveted, but I also think that's a real problem for democracies moving forward, is to have a bunch of people who are voting, not thinking in terms of a democracy, but thinking in terms of a monarchy. And so in some senses, why study Pentecostalism? Well, I had my reasons up till now, but my reasons now, fortunately, there seem to be no end of reasons. Does that make sense? Like if I want to study the world, it seems perfectly helpful to start with the group I know best.
Right. Well, and if you look at the world, like the globe, I mean, where Christianity is flourishing now in the majority world, right? South America, Asia, Africa, there's Pentecostalism very much, the warp and woof, I guess, of like what's going on in the world, from a Christian perspective.
Yeah, that's true. I think one thing, Curry, it's funny when I hear, and I'm not trying to correct you.
I'm unacquainted, so please, I'm always willing to be corrected.
I differentiate between what I think is true about who's Pentecostal now, right? And who's been Pentecostal. Yeah. Because when I was younger and I went to Southwestern Assemblies of God University, I think the conversation there was about, like, I think sometimes we called it the 80-20 window or like unreached populations. Like, there's been all these different ways of thinking about who is us and who is them. Mm. And right now that takes shape a lot in discussions about Pentecostals because it's become a global movement and people like to try to categorize, well, what does that mean? But for my, to my purposes, Pentecostalism, it flourishes in areas where there's a little less dedication to fundamentalism, or like there's a little less like preoccupation with like the tenets of the Enlightenment. So a little more comfortability around like having experiences that don't seem fully explainable. In the US, we got really, we went through a period where we really wanted to be scientific. Like,
yeah.
I mean, where we really put, and even now we have, I think, reasonable faith in science, but we also wanted to act very rationally. And I don't, I think that's understandable, but I think that not every nation has gone through that same preoccupation with like a scientifically reasonable way of being in the world. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
There are lots of other ways of being in the world. And I think that Pentecostalism has an easier time spreading around with people who are not like embarrassed to have, like, for instance, out of what looked to my mind like to be altered states of consciousness, yeah, or like, you know, like miracles at root, Curry, about not something happening that shouldn't be allowed to happen by the natural laws, right?
Right.
So like in a culture that's less committed to that or less preoccupied with that, I think the Pentecostal imagination can take root.
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. And I would say, I mean, it's hard for me to like think, like, these are big topics we're thinking about, right? Like global movements and, you know, you can't like generalize all of these things, but I guess I came from a world, you know, I went to Moody, which is very much in that, I would call it like sort of rationalistic, like, cessationist, very much a cessationist vein, you know, where like we can explain everything. We, you know, it's Father, Son, and Holy Bible sort of scenario, you know. I have a lot of like love for Pentecostals in making the Holy Spirit, like, or giving the Holy Spirit this place in the Trinity, right? The third person of the Trinity, like moving and active, you know? But it gets to another extreme, right? Where like these two just, like almost don't even, it's like we're worshiping different gods or something.
I made that point recently. It's like you're reading ahead of I just reviewed a book called Baptist and the Holy Spirit for an author named Doug Weaver. And he's a really great guy, but he was basically saying something really similar to what you're saying about the way that Baptists took on the concept of cessationism being really a marker of differentiation, Curry. Like, we're not like Pentecostals.
Right.
So like, they might not have actually been, Curry, historically. I love this. I love how these things get described by historians, but the pressure from differentiating from Pentecostals, I think, helped Baptists become more cessationist than they might have otherwise been. I mean, which is always like a, you can't rewrite history, but it's really interesting. So yeah, I think, and accordingly, actually, Curry, I think the Holy Spirit took on more of the disruptive capabilities and like the more of the movement and gifts, thinking under pressure from their co-religionists, like Baptists, people who ended up being in the Assemblies of God, but at this point, early Pentecostals are saying, well, no, we're going to go ahead and lay on the other side. So it was like kind of a winnowing. Does that make sense? It's kind of like a stress point produced two groups that might not have otherwise taken such extreme positions.
I mean, the same thing probably happened with the Reformation and Counter-Reformation, you know, in the, right? I mean, who knows where the Roman Catholic Church would be had the Reformation not actually happened, right? There was, there was a movement even for priests to be married. And I mean, there was a lot of things happening in the Catholic Church at the time.
Yeah, so, exactly. So, you're reading me exactly. Yeah. So yes, and Baptists, I think the point of this book was that Baptists were kind of coming around to more charismaticism. And I think actually Pentecostals are becoming slightly less capital P, right? So I think there's the kind of reaggregation to more shared sensibilities.
Yeah, that's good stuff. I'm so enjoying talking to you. Okay, so I got a couple more things I want to ask you about here. I didn't ask permission beforehand, so I don't, you know, if you're not comfortable talking about this, it's totally fine. But I was wondering, I mean, you're in the academy, and I know you're Latina, and so how do you have thoughts on sort of like being Latina and like in an academic setting, and you know, that sort
of thing? Actually, I guess my initial set of thoughts would be that I didn't really feel like I had a robust sense of my identity as a Latina until I got to the academy and got involved with a group called Hispanic Theological Initiative. And they were there to like support early stage scholars in their work getting the doctorate. And they're a really great group and became like a home base for me in my doctoral program. Mm-hmm. So actually, I don't think that consciousness of ethnicity is one of the things I'd grade high on the marks for like how Pentecostals educate people about their, sure, their subjectivity in the world. Right. Mm. And now I think as a scholar, we're all being called into a really close account of like the way that race hierarchies work and when people are benefiting from race hierarchies or when they are being abused by race hierarchies or like they're being disprivileged or having really negative experiences. And actually being somewhere in the middle between white and black is a really awkward, it's super awkward. I mean, it's not awkward ethically because, for instance, right now we're talking during Black Lives Matter protests and the deaths of Ahmaud Arbery and George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. I mean, those things aren't awkward. They're very clear ethical issues. But what you asked me about is like being in the academy and how is my experience being in academy? Actually, it's different because there are clearly times that I think I benefit, for instance, from not being a Black scholar. And I think there are other times that I'm clearly not a white scholar. So, I mean, I don't find this to be like terribly interesting, but I wanted to be honest, like in my answer. And I think one of the things that scholars are called now to do is to really be honest in their accounting of their own formation, as you've just asked me, and like their own work, like what part of your work speaks to this, that, or the other very important race-based or ethnicity-based reality. So my work, I do work with not just Hispanic Pentecostalism, but I'm planning my second book to be around the way that Hispanic Pentecostals in the Southwest are becoming Messianic Jews or some variation of Messianic Jews and have a repatriation like theme, like back to Israel.
That's really crazy.
It's, well, you would think, but actually it makes a lot of sense based on what's come before it. And so I think that I try not to just give lip service to like not just the protests or like lip service or like I care a lot about black scholars in the guild or I've benefited and I haven't benefited. Those kinds of things have become talking points, but I think by doing work, Curry, that really pays attention to the way that ethnicity based projects, which are always identity projects. So people who are making an ethnic identity, that's always a project, and really paying attention to how that works, what damages or actually what values come out of that is really important. Right. And so that's how I try to do it in my scholarship. I'm not saying the talking points are not important, but I think as scholars, that's the task. And it's a really high task because there are not that many, well, from my point, right, there are not that many female Hispanic PhDs. So we're working in religion. So it's a lot of work, but it's also a blessing, hashtag blessing. So, I mean, I'm lucky to be able to do the work, but it's certainly tall order.
Well, I know you were a professor for a time. I was listening to something recently, and I think I've probably talked about this a lot, but somebody asked, like, when's the first time you had a person of color who was your teacher, you know? And Like, looking back, I had had one in my, like, and I have two graduate degrees, you know what I mean? And I had had one African-American man in that entire time. And I think, especially in the theological world, like in grad school, all my professors were white men. And so when we did theology, we were doing white theology, but we were calling it just theology, right? Like, and I just think, yeah, especially in the theological world, my experience in the theological world is there's just not enough of understanding even the perspectives in which from which we do theology.
I want to be clear that I said what I meant to say before, because it's so important that we get this right. Like, what I meant to say is the deaths that we've recently witnessed, police at the hands of police, that's very clear ethical issue. It's wrong, and we need to attend to it immediately. So I want to be very clear that speaking from the guild and versus speaking as a public intellectual, those are two different tasks. And I think I'm so glad that the Black Lives Matter movement is having so much success. And wherever I can, I try to support the movement by interpreting it to people who would be slow to support or slow to understand. Sure. And then, but to your second question, because I wasn't sure I said that clearly the last few minutes, but to your second question around, like, is our sources too white in theological, like in theological programming, or have I had persons of color as my teachers? Absolutely, those questions are real, and you already know the answers to them, right? You know the answers to them. You haven't had enough spiritual formation that reflects non-white sources or non-hegemonic sources, right? Because it's not just color, it's also just like history, sociology, political history, money, economics, right? And you haven't had enough persons of color who are your teachers. So that's just true. And I think that that's what I meant by trying to be diligent in your work and to be honest about your own formation and the misformation, right, that most of us have had. I haven't had the same one as you have had. I grew up in a really ethnically diverse place, which was a gift. But it's still true that I read really weird versions of, for instance, Texas history. I mean, Curry, it's so funny to be taught a version of the history of the Alamo that is all like, and then the Mexican general Santa Anna came and he tried to take the Alamo from the Texans. And then the cast of Texans that they're talking about, the heroes of this are like Jim Bowie, Davy Crockett, they're white protagonists. And so there are just these clear ways, and that's just one glaring example, and it's true too of theology.
Yeah, my wife and I are both from Amarillo originally.
Okay.
So we very much, you know, imbibed all the Texas folklore, you know, our whole lives. Like that's how we understood all these things.
Oh, so. I love that. So we've been, I mean, add to that Pee Wee Herman's "There's No Basement in the Alamo." Do you remember this?
I don't remember this.
Okay, that's such a random theory. Like, there was a show called Pee Wee's Playhouse.
I remember Pee Wee's Playhouse for sure. I watched it too often.
He had a movie, and in it, his bike gets put in the basement in the Alamo. I know that's random, but I couldn't let you live without knowing that detail.
I totally remember that. I had forgotten that it got put in the Alamo. Oh my gosh.
Well, it didn't, because there's no basement in the Alamo.
There is
but
no
he
basement
thought
in the Alamo.
It was in the Alamo.
That's hilarious.
Now I got to go watch it back and watch Pee Wee Herman. So, yeah, right. Okay. So one final sort of trajectory, and this might be too big of a trajectory, but I guess for a long time, like, political engagement does not come naturally to me.
Okay.
I think it does to some people to some extent, but it's always been way easier for me not to engage in that sphere, right? It's awkward. It's uncomfortable. You know, I could be down with like anarchy, like Christian anarchy at any time, you know?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I understand it's important.
That sounds very political, but okay.
But in a way, it's saying that I don't have to mess with all the, like, I don't have to mess with all the sociological, the big questions. I can just sort of live my Christian life in my Christian world and be okay, You know, does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I think I want to hear how you ask this question though.
Okay. Well, so my question is like, how do you encourage people to engage politically, or just even the why behind all that? So I think there's a lot of people that it's a lot easier just not to engage at all.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think, Curry, it makes sense when you think about the units of time that we have and how much of our lives is busy, like making a living, you know, trying to keep our marriages on track if we're married, or maybe we're involved in church life. So how much time do we really have to devote to understanding like the overtly political world? And I think the way that I would motivate someone on that is like, actually, there's a surprising amount of power given to people, like rank and file people, in the construction of America's democracy. And that came at a really high price. Like no one just gave it up. No one, like monarchies didn't just say, you know what would be really interesting now is if we tried to just like have the people in power. Like that did not happen. And the reason I think that's important is I don't remember anybody stressing that to me either when I was younger. Like you have inherited relatively a lot of power and voice that didn't just happen. It was fought for. And I think that I would task you this way. Sure. America is one of the leading, if not the leading, democracy in the world. And if you think that democracy is by comparison somewhat better than dictatorships or other forms of government, and then if you care about how people over the world are living, if for instance you're invested in human rights, then you have actually a role to play in maintaining this democracy and promoting its well-being. Because actually what we do in the United States does affect political cultures elsewhere. And I think that the more people of faith get involved with a true understanding of what the stakes are and actually what the terms of democracy are, the better. And I'd actually like to be in conversation with you about that, because I think that there's reasons why the church feels really hesitant to wade into an arena that is hard to understand, but that work is ours to do.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I think that's helpful. Good correction. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It was awesome to talk to you.
It's amazing to talk to you. Thank you for having me.
Well, I hope you enjoyed hearing from Erica, and just like there's a lot of depth here, as you could tell. I mean, we could have gone off on any one of these topics in such a depth. And so, I hope you got something out of it. I hope this maybe challenged your thinking. I wonder if this episode didn't sort of help maybe push you along in your own story and why you do what you do because of your story. And I think that's an important thing to understand about our work and the reason we do what we do, the reason we have the passions that we have. And so I think it's not a bad idea to like look back at your story. What about your story makes you do the things that you do now, or what could you be doing sort of based on that? And so there's a lot to think about there. So hope you enjoyed hearing from Erica. You can go to the bottom of your iTunes app right now, and you can actually leave a rating and review down there, which helps get the word out about the podcast. It's just super helpful to me. I'd greatly appreciate you doing that. And until next time, get out there and hustle.